Certified technicians located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Alzheimer's disease, about what it is, and also talking about some of the research that's going on Alzheimer's to gain a better understanding of what causes the disease, who might be at risk, and to also develop treatments for people who have Alzheimer's disease. And our guest for the program is William Theis. He is Vice President for Medical and Scientific Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association in Chicago, Illinois. He oversees the largest private Alzheimer's disease research grants program in the world. He's been with the Alzheimer's Association now for a number of years. Before that, he also worked for the American Heart Association at its headquarters in Dallas, most recently as director of the Stroke Division. He's authored a number of articles and abstracts. He's also worked with the National Institute of Neurological Disease and Stroke to form the Brain Attack Coalition. He's also had faculty positions at Indiana University and University of Pittsburgh. By his academic training, he is a pharmacologist. He has a PhD in pharmacology from University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. By the way, I also want to mention the fact that he will be speaking here in our area 1 week from today. He'll be a speaker at the annual fall conference of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Illinois. This will be taking place at the Urbana, at the Holiday Inn Conference Center in Urbana, as I said, 1 week from today. This is November 14th. A Map Through the Maze, a conference for professional and family caregivers dealing with memory loss. And he'll be speaking, and there will be other events associated with this. And if you're interested in finding out more information about it, or you would like to register, you can do that online by going to the website www.alzheimers-illinois.org. So you can find out about that. And perhaps a little bit later in the program, Dr. Theis can talk a little bit about this event. Questions, however, are certainly welcome. The idea here is we'd like to just cover the basics on Alzheimer's and give people the opportunity to ask questions. And you can do that very easily by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-9455, again, for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Theis, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Doing well this morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us. Just to ask some of the most basic questions, maybe I'll begin by asking about the incidence of Alzheimer's disease. How many people have Alzheimer's, and have the numbers been going up?
Well, we estimate that currently there are 4.5 million people in the United States with Alzheimer's. And yes, the numbers are going up, and they're going to go up astronomically over the next 30 or 40 years. This is really due to two influences. One is everybody's living longer, but the most important thing for the next few years is that the post-World War II baby boom population is about to go through the ages where they are most likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. And so that has the potential to as much as triple or quadruple the number of people with the disease. It's already common, and it's going to become overwhelming.
So it is simply a result of demographics. That is, that we're going to have a larger number of people who are in the age range where the likelihood of Alzheimer's developing is the greatest.
Yes, that's right, and that's going to put us in a circumstance where we are not going to be able to deal with this disease because it's a disease that requires a great deal of care for the people who have it, and it's very expensive, and we will not have the workforce to take care of the people with the disease, and we won't have the money to pay for it as we look at the projections over the next 30 or 40 years.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm sure that people wonder about, and there is obviously a lot of research directed toward, is answering the question, what causes Alzheimer's disease? And I think that it's still something that we really don't know. When you talk about risk factors, I would imagine that one that you can point to is family history, but I suppose that's not a guarantee either. What do we know about what causes Alzheimer's disease?
Well, we know that Alzheimer's disease is a result of both genetics and the environment. As far as what causes it, what is that very initial event that triggers Alzheimer's disease, we don't know that. And one of the reasons that it is going to be very hard to find is it's likely that Alzheimer's disease starts as much as 20 years before symptoms occur. And so relating any single event 20 years ago with something that's happening today is very, very difficult. But we do know that there is a genetic relationship because there is some increased likelihood of developing the disease if it's been in your family. We also know from identical twin studies that it has to have something to do with the environment because, in fact, identical twins can develop the disease as much as 30 years apart. Mm-hmm. And so that suggests there are at least two influences.
Is there any – I know that there has been some concerns in the past about certain kinds of let's say environmental toxins, things mm-hmm. that might be in the environment that people might absorb. For example, I think that at one point there was concern about aluminum, and that I think was because post-mortem, when you looked at the brains of people who had Alzheimer's disease, they found aluminum, and someone said, well, maybe that's it. And then I think after that, others said, well, we're not really sure that has any bearing or there was any relationship between that and Alzheimer's disease. I'm sure that there are some other sorts of things specifically on that issue. Is there anything, do we have any particular reason to believe that being exposed to certain kind of things might indeed increase your risk?
Well, it certainly is not as simple as aluminum, which I think of as the myth that will not die. That comes up in almost every discussion around Alzheimer's disease. It was first suggested quite a number of years ago, it's perfectly clear that the sort of exposures to aluminum that one might be able to control are not going to have any impact in the disease. One of the problems with controlling aluminum is one of the most common elements in the Earth's crust, and so you are constantly exposed to large amounts of it. So throwing away your aluminum pots and pans is probably of no value whatsoever. The fact is we have not been able to point to any specific toxins. We do know that there's a sort of a series of markers that we might attach to higher presence of Alzheimer's disease. And those are things that we've actually heard of before. They really are risk factors for blood vessel disease. So if we look at things like high-fat diets, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, sedentary lifestyle, and in the case of Alzheimer's disease, social isolation and lack of exercise, all of those things fit together into a pattern that seems to result in more Alzheimer's disease. So in terms of controlling those kinds of things in your environment, we put together a program called Maintain Your Brain, which is really aimed at trying to keep people as functional as possible, as long as possible. And clearly, when you look at the public health impact of these kinds of interventions, they're all really good ideas. And with people living much longer, it would really be a good idea to start some of these things, at least in a modest way, as early as possible.
Mm-hmm. Pardon me for interrupting there, but I was particularly interested in this issue of, was there any connection between cardiovascular disease which we know plays a role in stroke. And now we, for a long time, because heart disease is such an issue in this country, that we've been talking a lot about doing things that you can prevent to do, the things you can do to prevent heart disease. And there's also a connection from there to stroke, because it's really a very, it's very much the same kind of, some of the same kind of mechanisms seem to be at work. So there, the kinds of things you might do to reduce your risk of heart disease would have also another benefit, because it would have an impact on stroke as well. And I was interested to see in your background that, in fact, you had worked for the Heart Association and that you were director of their stroke division. Is there some connection between those things that contribute to some really good connection that we can point to between those things that contribute to risk of heart disease and stroke and Alzheimer's?
Well, I think there is a linkage, we can see it in a couple of different ways. One is that stroke and small blood vessel disease in the brain can result in dementia, and we also know that dementias sort of add up algebraically. That is, if you have some changes that would lead to dementia from your vascular system and also some Alzheimer's pathology, you will actually have symptoms of dementia much sooner. And that relationship is pretty clear. Lots of people who have advanced blood vessel disease or Alzheimer's disease will be elderly and will have a little bit of both. But one of the more interesting things that's come along in recent years is people looking for sort of biochemical linkages between some of the characteristics of Alzheimer's disease and the characteristics of blood pressure disease, or blood vessel disease. So people have found, for instance, that if you take some of these genetically engineered mice that have some of the aspects of Alzheimer's disease, and they make an extra compound or make more of a compound called amyloid. And if you feed those mice a high cholesterol diet, they'll make more amyloid. If you treat them with statin drugs or put them on a low cholesterol diet, they'll make less amyloid. So it would appear as if there may also be a direct biochemical linkage between blood vessel disease and Alzheimer's disease, in that they may have some of the same influencers.
All right. Let's talk with someone who was listening here who has a question over in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. My first question, I think you pretty well answered it, but I'll ask it anyway in case there's areas you could fill up. Then there's two short ones. One, I was going to ask you to cover the sort of, I'll call it, quote-unquote, markers for Alzheimer's, and you've already talked about some of the cholesterol problems and things like that. I wondered along the way if you could explain the difference between blood vessel disease, and I've not heard too much about that. Being a person who has high blood pressure and taking pills, and also diabetic, that sort of thing interests me greatly. I could give a quickie on the statin drugs, which depends on which newscast you're watching on TV and which internet site you go to, get a bad mouth reputation now, though they're still being offered by doctors, I know as a fact. And I guess the third thing is the relationship between Alzheimer's and the environment. You've ruled out aluminum. I was wondering if there's been any multivariant studies that don't show really what you'd say strong correlation, but it just sort of have little pips, you know, in certain areas, which, you know, for the person who wants to be really careful and play all these cards, would like to know about that sort of thing. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the first part of that question was markers for Alzheimer's disease, and we can just go over those again rather quickly. But as we said, clearly having the disease in the family will convey some increased risk. There is at least one gene, the APOE gene, that specifically increases risk to individuals if you have the wrong form of the gene. And then We might look at a whole bunch of things that we would think of as being environmental, perhaps, which would include things like low physical activity, high body weight, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugar, lack of social contact, and lack of mental stimulation. I think I got the whole package there. Those are the best ones we have at the moment. As far as the blood vessel disease is really what happens when you get heart disease and stroke. I mean, you get those because you have problems in the blood vessels that that are supplying either the heart or the brain. And so that's sort of a general term for all of that lumped together. There are other kinds of blood vessel diseases. You can get it in your leg, and then you'll have trouble with your leg muscles and that sort of thing. And then I didn't quite understand. There was a comment about the statin drug.
Well, I guess, yeah, and I don't this is getting into a very different area, getting into talking about heart disease. Obviously, these are the drugs that some people take to lower cholesterol. And you did say that there was among the many, this big package of factors that might be a sign that a person would be at greater risk for Alzheimer's. One of them would be high cholesterol.
Right, clearly one of the statin drugs are perhaps a potential answer to that, and there is a clinical trial going on now that is trying, or two of them really, two big ones that are really aimed at trying to see if giving people with Alzheimer's disease one of the statin drugs will result in a decrease in the progression of the disease. So it may turn out that these drugs are useful. I think we don't know that useful in Alzheimer's disease, but the one thing I would like to say is that these drugs have had a long history of being well tolerated and effective in lowering cholesterol. So if you have elevated cholesterol, and that's a moving target, what's elevated keeps going down because of the fact that we realize that the lower you get it, at least up to some nominal limits, the better it seems to be, and that these drugs have a very, very solid safety history. So I think that if your physician tells you that you need one of these drugs, you ought to do that. Taking them for Alzheimer's disease now would be premature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the last part of the question was the relationship between Alzheimer's disease and the environment. I think the only piece there that we may not have talked about is head injury. There does seem to be a linkage between severe head injury and Alzheimer's disease. So that's a good reason to protect yourself from falls if you ride a bike or a motorcycle, wear a helmet. But the sort of head injuries we're talking about there are head injuries that render people unconscious for more than 24 hours. So it's a serious head injury. The linkage between Alzheimer's disease and lower level repetitive head injuries, like you might see in some of the sports or something like that, is not clearly established at mm-hmm. this point. Otherwise, I think we do not have any good linkages between Alzheimer's pathology and sort of traditional environmental toxins like volatile chemicals and things like that. They can damage the brain, but they don't necessarily cause Alzheimer's pathology.
Given the fact that one of the risk factors is family history, and that there is in particular a gene that seems to increase one's risk of developing disease, are you anywhere near to the point of saying that perhaps some people should consider having genetic screening to find out whether they have this particular gene?
You know, the problem with that is that if we found all those people, we wouldn't have much we could do for them at this point. I think it makes sense if you have a family history of Alzheimer's that you might want to adopt the things that are in our Maintain Your Brain program earlier, or you might take them and do them a little more intensively. But what we don't have at this point in time is a treatment that stops the progression of the disease. We have some treatments. They're useful. They can, in fact, offer us some symptomatic relief from the disease, but the disease will continue to progress. So we can't identify people before they're symptomatic or people who are at high risk and offer them a treatment that would lower that risk. In that setting, it doesn't really make sense to do this genetic screening. The good news is the next generation of medications that are being tested already are all aimed at a goal of what we might call disease modification. That is, changing the progression of the disease. That is, slowing the loss of cognitive function so that we can, in fact, identify people with the disease very early and then prevent them from getting worse. And, of course, as soon as that's proven, we'll want to identify people who are at high risk and perhaps treat them so that they don't develop the disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, that let me just ask you one other question. I have several callers, and it does go to this issue of diagnosis, mm-hmm. which I think has for a long time now been kind of difficult because for one thing, the symptoms of Alzheimer's, they can be caused by other things. That I think for a long time it was the case, and I'm not sure if it still is, but for a long time it was the case, the only way that you could make a definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's actually was postmortem, after the person had died. Where do things stand now with diagnosis?
Well, the clinical diagnosis that you can get from a physician who is experienced at looking at people with Alzheimer's disease is pretty good. It's ultimately just about as good as the diagnosis you will get postmortem, and so that's 90 to 95% correct. But that occurs when there are visible behavioral symptoms. People have to begin to have memory loss before you can identify that. One of the things that people are working on are a variety of diagnostic techniques that will really look at the biology of the disease and might allow us to identify the presence of the disease maybe even many years before people become symptomatic. And that's very important research work.
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. William Theis. He is the Vice President for Medical and Scientific Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association, and he will be here in Champaign-Urbana 1 week from today giving a talk to take part in the 17th Annual Fall Conference of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Illinois. This will be taking place in Urbana at the Holiday Inn Conference Center. And anyone who is interested in attending can get more information or can register online by going to the website of the Alzheimer's Association, which is www.alzheimers-illinois.org. Otherwise, questions are welcome, and we have several people who are lined up and ready to go. And we'll go first to someone in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have MS, and I'm on an Alzheimer's drug called Aricept. And I was recently told that ischemia showed up on my MRI. What does that mean?
On an MRI of your brain?
Right.
Yeah. Ischemia is just a big word for not enough blood.
Is that going to affect my mental acuity?
On an MRI, what you see is usually not function unless you have a very special MRI test, which is called a functional MRI. And I don't know whether that's available in your area or not. It's really a research tool primarily. So what they can see are areas of old ischemia, that is, places that didn't have enough oxygen supply for some period of time. And eventually that will have some impact, yes.
That old?
I'm sorry?
This is a change in the last 3 years, so it's not that old.
Yes, but changes in brain function due to loss of oxygen happen in a matter of minutes. So if you had an episode like that, it would appear on an MRI for maybe many years, but it would have happened just in a very short period of time.
Right, sure. What causes it?
Well, there are a large number of causes, and that include blockages in blood vessels, or spasms in blood vessels, or almost anything that decreases the blood flow below a certain level. And then you can get it sometimes from poor heart perfusion. That is, your heart isn't working very well. I'm assuming your physicians are looking through all of this and are integrating this information into your general care and should be looking at all this stuff.
Never mentioned to me. You said your MRI is exactly the way it was in 2002. I just happened to read the report that I'm taking up to Mayo. So, no, nobody looked at it, but I'll have them look at it at Mayo.
That would be a good idea.
Hey, thanks for your help.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Urbana next, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the doctor about a article I clipped from the Daily Mirror in the UK. It was referencing in early October, some article in The Lancet from a Swedish study by a doctor. It looks like Mia Kivipelto, and they were looking at 1,500 people, all elderly, and they found that working out twice a week in middle age cuts the chance of getting Alzheimer's disease by 60%. And they defined exercising by or working out by 20 to 30 minutes of activity, which causes breathlessness and sweating. And I didn't hear anybody pick it up in the States here, and I was wondering if you knew anything about it or had any comments.
Sure. And in fact, we talked about it to a couple of media outlets, and I think that got some play. Dr. Kivipelto is one of the researchers who has published very broadly around this issues of risk factors and Alzheimer's disease, and has the ability to watch a very large population over quite a number of years. And in fact, in Sweden and Finland both, because of their healthcare system, they collect data from people over a large number of years. And those studies have been very influential in driving our interest in encouraging people to be more active. In many ways, exercise is sort of a foundation risk factor, because if you get more exercise, typically you'll weigh less, and your blood pressure goes down, and your blood cholesterol goes down, and your blood sugar goes down. So all those good things happen if you have some regular physical activity. And one of the things that has become pretty clear in the literature is that the levels of physical activity that you need for health may not be too huge. They may not require you to run marathons or anything really big like that, but rather just regular physical activity. And I just might emphasize here, the key is physical activity, not necessarily some sort of structured exercise. One of the things that's really hardest to get people to do is change their habits. And so if you tell people they have to exercise and they interpret that as getting dressed up in their gym clothes and going off to a different place and working out on some awful machine or going for a run or something like that, they may just not do that because they don't like it. On the other hand, they'd be perfectly comfortable going and taking a nice brisk walk. And so being able to tailor physical activity to your own interests. If you like to go to the gym, that's great. Go do it. But if you like doing something else, that is that causes you to move physically, that may do just as much good.
It sounds like you wouldn't press the point where it comes to like sweating and breathlessness. You would be happier that they just have physical exercise.
I think it is the activity. And there was another study not too long ago that showed dancing was a particularly useful form of physical activity. And I suppose unless you're dedicated to the polka, you don't get sweaty and breathless too often when you're dancing. So I think lower levels of activity can work. The researchers have to actually figure out a question they're going to ask people that will allow them to sort of separate them into groups. That doesn't mean that that's the only thing that you need to do.
Well, I'll stop hounding my wife then. Thank you.
All right, let's go on here to another caller. We'll go to someone in Indiana, Prairie Creek, Indiana. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is there any correlation between migraine and or seizures and Alzheimer's?
It was migraines and seizures?
Migraines or seizures?
I have not seen any literature around either of those and Alzheimer's. I think there's no great collection of cases with people that would have an early history. An early history of depression can sometimes increase your risk of Alzheimer's disease, but not migraines and seizures that I'm aware of.
Okay, well, what were the postmortem markers for Alzheimer's?
For Alzheimer's disease, there are really two characteristic lesions for Alzheimer's disease. They're sort of abbreviated in science discussions to plaques and tangles. The plaques are outside of brain cells, and they're made up of an altered normal protein called amyloid. And in people who have Alzheimer's disease, this amyloid changes very subtly, and then it accumulates in the brain. And then the other characteristic lesion is the neurofibrillary tangle, which occurs inside of brain cells. And these tangles are made up of a normal intracellular protein called tau, and this tau gets a few additional phosphate units added to it, and when that happens, it causes it to keep from working, and it will then accumulate in these very dense tangles inside the brain cells, and either of those lesions is toxic to the nerve cell.
Okay. Whatever happened to the? There was supposed to be an aluminum film around the outside of the brain, or whatever was that was supposedly how it was diagnosed. Whatever happened.
All of the findings around aluminum really have not been borne out over time, and so it appears as if there is not a close relationship between aluminum and Alzheimer's.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go again to another caller, Bourbonnais. Is this listener, line number 1? Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Would you please distinguish between the symptoms of normal aging and the early symptoms of Alzheimer's? And would you please include in that a discussion of what is called mild cognitive impairment, which I understand is actually something of a predictor for Alzheimer's, and is also mighty like normal aging?
Okay. The key difference between normal aging and Alzheimer's disease is that when one gets to a stage of being demented, memory loss gets to the point where it begins to interfere with your activities of daily living. And one of the things that we know happens in the brain is that as it ages, it has some normal changes that actually tends to slow down memory. It doesn't necessarily make it any worse, but it just takes longer to get to the information you're looking for. And so one of the ways that we talk about it is that if you lose your car keys someplace and eventually find them, that's not a sign of any disease, of dementia. If you forget what your car keys do, then clearly that's a sign that this is a very different kind of memory loss and is really separate from normal aging. I think the second part of that question was aimed at mild cognitive impairment. Mild cognitive impairment is a change in memory function primarily that isn't enough to be Alzheimer's disease, but it's too much to be normal. So you can see mild cognitive impairment on some very specific tests that are designed for it. And if you have a certain form of MCI, that is MCI that's primarily characterized by a memory problem, then that does increase your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Mild cognitive impairment is really just an improvement in our ability to recognize the early symptoms of the disease. It becomes an important research tool because people are now trying to do clinical trials with MCI as opposed to Alzheimer's disease, because you'd like to arrest people in the stage of MCI, not let them get on to Alzheimer's disease. Because people with MCI can usually live in the community and live on their own fairly well, they will have some minor memory issues.
Let me ask two more questions, if I may. What constitutes interference with daily living? I mean, if I can't remember somebody's name, that's a detriment.
As somebody who has this fundamental rule personally that I never remember anybody's name until I've been really seriously embarrassed at least once, I have every sympathy for not being able to remember names. But the fact is that you can keep yourself fed and clothed and get around town essentially with some aids, and there are some ways that you can improve that kind of problem. But when you can't remember how to get home from someplace when you've gone there, or go out of your house and walk two blocks away and can't remember how to get back to your house, when people begin to forget sort of normal hygiene, forget to feed themselves, those are the sorts of things that now begin to get in the way of just basic human maintenance and begin to require some sort of assistance if people are going to continue to live on their own, or may require some sort of care in some sort of specialized care environment. I wish I could give you a really simple, precise key, but the fact is that as we look at the continuum from normal aging to Alzheimer's disease, that very first event that is a pathological event will be indistinguishable from the very last event that was a normal memory slip. So there's going to be a certain amount of overlap. But as Alzheimer's progresses, it becomes perfectly clear that this is a person who is now having difficulty doing all of the things that they used to be able to do. And the sort of classic story you will hear is an accountant who worked for many years as a CPA and now can't manage their own checking account. I mean, that's the sort of change that clearly ought to get further evaluation.
And that's the sort of thing, not being able to find your way home or execute your own hygiene, that's the sort of memory impairment, of mild cognitive impairment that is that what you're saying?
No, mild cognitive impairment usually doesn't show elements of that. That's why it's not called dementia. Mild cognitive impairment usually turns out in some very, very specific tests that are around around your memory, and it'll be remembering a series of numbers or remembering a story sometime after it's been told to you. People with mild cognitive impairment will usually be out in the community and managing on their own.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, I would like to introduce our guest. We're talking with Dr. William Theis. He is Vice President for Medical and Scientific Affairs of the Alzheimer's Association. And he will be here speaking in Champaign-Urbana 1 week from today. This would be the annual fall conference of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Illinois. It takes place at the Holiday Inn Conference Center in Urbana. And if you'd like to find out more about this or to register online, you can go to the Alzheimer's website. That's www.alzheimers-illinois.org. Just, I have a couple of other callers here, but I want to make sure before we end up finding ourselves out of time, I want to give you the opportunity to talk just a little bit about treatment. We've talked a lot about risk factors. We've talked about symptoms. We really haven't talked about what at this point physicians have to offer for people who have Alzheimer's and for their families.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of features of current treatment. There are four drugs that are currently available. Three of them are all in the same class, so they work the same way, and then there's a newer drug which is in a different class. They all improve the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease in the sort of tests that people use to evaluate them. They improve people's memory. They don't stop the progression of the disease, so the disease will continue on. But in fact, these medications have proved to be very useful in many, many people in terms of increasing or maintaining their functionality over an additional period of time. The response to the drugs is a bit variable. Some people respond very well to them. Other people don't respond as well. So if you're one of the people who doesn't respond on the first drug you try, probably you want to ask your doctor to try something else. The treatments that are coming up are in the pipeline, if you will, for further development. The next generation of drugs are going to be aimed at, as we said before, this goal of disease modification, that is, slowing the progression. And as these drugs begin to come online, they may, in fact, increase the utility of the current drugs as well. Because obviously, if you can identify people very close to the beginning of symptoms, and you can arrest them in that condition, and then give them some small incremental benefit, that's going to end up returning them pretty close to normal, and that would be a great accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. And at what point would you expect those drugs would be generally available?
I think those drugs will. The first ones will be tested over the next, and some of them are in clinical trials now, so we'll be getting data over the next 3 to 5 years, which means that provided they're successful, probably something in the 5 to 7 year range.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some other calls here. Both of them are in Urbana, here where we are. Next up is line number 2. Hello.
Hello, is that myself?
Yes.
Oh, great. If you could direct more comments towards the debunking of the aluminum factor with regard to causal or symptomatic, whatever connection it has with Alzheimer's, I'd appreciate that. Excuse me, especially in light of the historical nature of aluminum and how it's shown to be a neurotoxin with the same effect, short-term memory loss, et cetera. Historically, you know, the island of Guam and an island in Japan as well, it had high bauxite, and I think that's the source of aluminum. When the soil was real high and, the vegetables were ingested, it was the same sort of reaction in people with regard to short-term memory loss. As soon as that was taken out of their diets, they returned to normal function. If you could address comments to aluminum, and also, you know, it's very fascinating that you bring up the concussion correlation, because that was one of the theories strung with associated with the manifestation of Alzheimer's symptoms in people, namely is that with bad diet and concussion, then the aluminum, which was normally part of the magnesium-calcium ratio that was absorbed in the body with the bad diet rather than calcium-magnesium, aluminum was wicked up in there and then plated on the brain through either concussion or through stroke, with aluminum having the effect of short-circuiting and plating with blood getting directly to the brain, aluminum depositing on it and short-circuiting the circuit in the brain, and thus, you know, the accumulation of aluminum in the short term, and so on. Well, Lisa, okay. Please comment.
Yeah, this has to be at least about the fourth time that the subject of aluminum has come up here during the conversation. As you said earlier, it's the thing that just won't go away.
It yeah. really won't, and it comes up repeatedly. The fact is that we've been able to establish no real relationship between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease, some of the early work and aluminum is still used as sort of a standard toxin to nerve cells, but it's putting aluminum metal on the surface of a exposed brain cortex, so it's a totally different sort of thing than what you see at in any kind of dietary ingestion. So no matter how big a study we do and no matter how much attention we pay to it, I suspect that the aluminum myth will continue to come back, but let me say it again, there's no relationship between aluminum and Alzheimer's.
All right, I thank the call. Let's go to line number 3. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. We've had two family members, elderly family members, that have developed dementia. It's not clear it was Alzheimer's, but what we noticed was difficulty in making decisions in new circumstances with one person who was driving behind them and watching them drive, and dealing with unexpected driving situations. They clearly weren't able to, they're able to follow in, to do things that they always did. But if something was unusual, they clearly had unable to deal healthily with that change in circumstances. And with one person, he wanted to do some genealogy, and I found a book for him at a library with a bunch of people, with a bunch of the surnames we were looking for. And I said, why don't you just photocopy these pages that are in the index for this surname, and then we'll look at it later. Now, this person was, he'd been an electrical engineer, and he could not do that task. And I hadn't realized that things were that difficult. I said to him, what's wrong? Why are you still sitting here? He said, I don't know where to start.
Well, that is a fairly typical description. And you said a couple of things that are really highlights. Number one, it was a change from what these people could always do. And number two, it's can be subtle at onset, and people will always sort of say, oh, well, you know, that really is just a bad day or whatever it is. But as you begin to see that in folks around you, if they haven't been evaluated by a physician who's used to looking at Alzheimer's disease, you ought to encourage them to do that, because getting a diagnosis can be really important. And one of the reasons it's important is that sometimes these changes that people go through are very difficult to understand for the family. And there's a lot of research that says very clearly that families that are informed about the disease and understand that these changes are the consequence of the disease really cope with it much better. And that's actually part of the reasons why the the Illinois chapter is going to have the conference in Urbana to really try to increase people's information base so that they can understand these changes for what they are. There's also some information about how to deal with some of the issues around the sort of problematical things about driving and that sort of thing that people need help with.
Well, with one person, I took him to the Memory and Aging Clinic at SIU in Springfield, mm-hmm. Their medical center, and it was interesting because he did pretty well on their memory test. And he's an intelligent guy. He could figure out what they wanted. But the doctors paid close attention to what we, the family, were telling them about what we were seeing. And they did start him on an Alzheimer's medication, and it did stop the getting lost, mm-hmm. and it made him sleep better. And those two things made a big difference in terms of being able to have him live at home. And I said to him, "He's to be getting here too soon," and because I was really insistent on getting him in to see somebody, I said to, and the way that I finally got cooperation, because he was sure nothing was wrong, was I said, "This is what I'm seeing, and I'm concerned that maybe you had a stroke, maybe you have, I know there are several things like vitamin B12, thyroid, a couple of things that can cause confusion that are not Alzheimer's and that are reversible, and it's important to look for those kinds of things as well."
That's a very good point. In fact, in a very large study not too long ago of a memory clinic population, they found that 25% of the people who came into the clinic with complaints around their memory had a reversible cause, and so that means a quarter of those people could be treated and return to normal. And so I think that's something that that is always a good reason to get these things investigated.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller and somebody else we can't take, but we're here at the end of the time. I do want to mention one more time, though, however, that our guest for this morning, Dr. William Thies from the Alzheimer's Association, will be speaking at the fall conference, the annual fall conference of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Illinois. That takes place 1 week from today at the Holiday Inn Conference Center in Urbana. This is A Map Through the Maze, a conference for professional and family caregivers dealing with memory loss. For more information or to register online, go to the website of the Alzheimer's Association, which is www.alzheimers-illinois.org. And Dr. Thies, thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it, David.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. We're going to break, have news and update on the markets, then more Focus. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in